This is an interview with Jill Considine for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. Today is August 1st, 2011. I am James Stoker. We're talking at an office in downtown Manhattan. Welcome, Jill.
Good morning, James.
Okay, Jill, I'd like to start at the beginning in these interviews. I understand that you were born in Florida. Did you grow up there?
No, actually, I didn't. I happened to be in Florida. My father was stationed at an Air Force base, and my mother was down there with him. So I was born there, and we probably headed back to New York, which was home after about 6 months.
So you were a military brat.
Yes, but not for a very long time. But yes, I did have that as my history.
Okay. Did either of your parents work in finance or anything like that?
Not at all. My father worked for the Herald Tribune. My mom was basically a homemaker. Later on, worked for a doctor. But neither one of them had been involved in finance or anyone in my family.
You attended St. John's University in New York, right?
Correct.
I understand that you studied biochemistry there.
Yes. Well, I guess what happened was I graduated from high school when I was 16, and I knew I was going to go to college, and I had to decide what I was going to be studying. If you think back at the time, there were really no role models for women. I knew of Clara Barton and Madame Curie, so science seemed to be something that women were in if you didn't want to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I enrolled as a biochemistry major.
So you knew from the beginning of your college career that you wanted to do sciences?
Yes, I did. And when I was in high school, I was in the science club and did a lot of experiments and had planaria, which were these little organisms that I used to cut in pieces and see if they could regenerate. So, yeah, I guess I had sort of a wonkish bent from very early on.
And you did graduate work in biochem also.
I did. I went to Bryn Mawr, and I studied there in biochemistry. As a matter of fact, I think the title of the thesis I wrote was The Uptake of L-Rabinose in Tetrahymena piriformis, which was about as... I think
I'm sure someone out there will understand.
Wonkish as you can get, but I had worked there, and then when I left Bryn Mawr, I actually went to the Blood Center, which was a research arm of the Red Cross, and I did research there in nucleic acid, mm-hmm. RNA, and DNA. And this was at a time that no one had ever heard of nucleic acids. It was before all the TV shows and all the DNA that we know of today, and did a lot of the work that is actually used today for DNA typing. And actually some of the experiments that we did turned out to have some useful benefits in terms of getting unicellular organisms to produce higher level substances that could be used in drug treatment.
So when did you realize that you weren't going to spend the rest of your career in a laboratory?
I guess there were two points. Number one, whether I was going to complete my PhD thesis. That was one, and I kept on saying, do I really want to do this? And then the other thing was, when I was in the laboratory, I was trying to decide whether I wanted to take a trip cross country with a girlfriend and drive cross country, or go to Europe for several weeks with some other friends. And I went in and talked to the person who ran the lab and said, I'm fairly flexible. What would work better for your schedule? And he said, well, you really can't do that. I'm planning to take the summer off. Mm. And I need you here to run the lab. And at that point, I said, whoa. And my great aunt had died and left me some money, and I knew I had some money available. So I decided I was going to do both. And I drove cross country and also went to Europe and spent, I guess almost a year all told in traveling. And that's when the bug bit me.
Mm-hmm. And then you came back and needed a job.
I came back and I needed a job. Every time I sent out my resume, I would get an offer to work in a laboratory, and I realized that that is not what I wanted to do. I'm much more of a people person. And a girlfriend's husband was actually at Bankers Trust and said, why don't you come in for an interview? And I said, I don't want to work for a bank. Bankers are boring. I don't want to work there. Well, he set up an interview, and I came in, I think, about 9:30 in the morning. Now, remember, I was a junior person out of college. I interviewed from 9:30 until 6:30 that night. I saw probably everyone there. They were hiring me as a systems programmer. And at the time, I had no idea what systems programming was.
Had you ever done any computer programming?
No. This was really the early stages. It was a IBM 360, which was about the size of a room, and actually had the computing capacity of maybe a BlackBerry, but I think probably less than that. I had done no computer programming, but they didn't know about science either. So we had this incredible conversation where they tried to explain to me what software and hardware was, and I tried to explain what I had been doing in science. I wish I had taped that interview, because I seem to remember at one point I told them that, why not hire me, and I will bring the scientific method into banking and computers. So I started at Bankers Trust, and I was in what was called systems programming, and we actually programmed the computers themselves. We had these little green cards that we walked around with. It was punch cards that were available at the time. And space was a very, very valuable commodity. So you actually instructed the computer to move what was in field A into field B, and then take field B and add it to field C and store it all in field D. Very wonkish, very very technical, but it gave me a fabulous base in terms of understanding technology.
Were there many other women working at the bank at that time?
Actually, in computers, there were probably more than you would see in the banking. It was a new field. Probably only maybe 20%, but it was a new field, and with a new field, you didn't have sort of the pipeline of people who'd been coming through on the loan side or the traditional parts of the bank. So I worked there, and I'd say 20% were women.
Okay, not too bad. And then 2 years later, you moved to Chase Manhattan.
Right.
Did your position change there, or were you doing sort of the same thing, more or less?
Well, actually, I had been at Bankers Trust, and a friend of mine who worked there had been called by a headhunter about the job over at Chase. And she said, I think this would be absolutely perfect for you. And I said, oh, I don't really know whether I want to change. She said, well, it's worth going over for an interview. And I spoke to them, and I went over. I was going to be working with a group that was in a highly technical area. And as things at the time changed, I was there, and about 2 weeks later, the department was reorganized and sort of disappeared. And they asked me to teach the technical programming. And that started me on a very different twist in my career. I did technical training, and then there was a whole issue in terms of how do you train people, how do you career path them, how do you know who's got the right skill set. And they chose six of us to run various departments. And I had 600 systems programmers reporting into me, in a way, in a matrix organization. And it would be my responsibility to decide where they would go next, what their career should be, what skills they were lacking, assign them to projects. Mm-hmm. It was a centralized warehouse for systems programmers.
So this was your first big managerial experience?
Yes, it was managerial, but it was managerial in a matrixed staff way. Which was a very, very good management tool, because when you're on a staff side, you don't have all that control. You have to learn how to work through persuasion and sort of on the sidelines. It's not a command and control environment, which, as the world has changed, as management and leadership has changed, was probably a very, very good background for me to have.
Now, this position, you traveled a lot, too.
Well, when the traveling started, actually what happened, I was in that role, and technology was really becoming the driver of everything in banking. And a group called SWIFT was getting established then, and the United States was supposed to come on in 1977. And it turned out that we were going to be doing money transfers, and we were going to take money transfers and send them globally, and we'd be receiving in money transfers from all over. SWIFT initially was set up to replace telex and mail. And not all the big banks were very interested in having this happen because they all had their own proprietary networks, and it was, why do I want to join in this? I have a competitive advantage that I have this global network. SWIFT was automated, and Chase went and looked at purchasing systems that were out there and available, and Chase at the time was the largest money transfer bank in the world, and realized that there was no system that was large enough to handle. It was going to be an interface between SWIFT and chips. So the messages would come in, the bank would work on them, and then settle them through the chip system. And they decided they were going to build their own system. It became almost an impossibility to do. It got behind schedule. And they asked me to come in because I had some international background, I had some systems background, and I knew some money transfer. And they figured it would cut down on integration matters if I were the integrator. And we built the first real-time online system at the time. And it was a SWIFT to CHIPS interface.
Yeah, I think I saw an article that was written back in the 90s that suggested that you scheduled your wedding date so as not to
interfere
with this rollout.
I did. SWIFT and CHIPS were supposed to go live in September, and my husband and I were trying to figure out when we were going to get married. And he was working on the mayoral campaign for Koch, so he didn't want to get married in the fall because of the Koch campaign, and I didn't want to get married as it would interfere with what was going on in the early spring and early summer. So we argued back and forth and finally came up with an August date because it fit in with both of our schedules.
Okay. Now, this is taking a step back just a couple of years for just a moment, but were you working on chips during the Bankhaus Herstatt crisis?
No, that was in 1974.
Okay, so that was before you got involved in that.
That was before I got involved, but Herstatt had a very strong impact on chips and work that was done at the clearinghouse and work that was done with payment systems.
Would you say that was one of the drivers behind this this integration of the creation of the new SWIFT system?
I think what was really behind the integration of the SWIFT system was probably trying to reduce cost, have the efficiency. You cannot imagine the amount of paper that was in the back rooms of money transfer organizations. And sometimes it would get so high that they would try to sort it and only handle 5 million and up money transfers. Now, this is back in in the 70s, a very, very, a very different time. So Herstatt was there. People were beginning to realize that there was a lot of risk in money transfer, that it was not just a means of moving money, that there was risk inherent in it, that people may not get paid on the other side, that there was a global environment, that we were working in different time zones, had different legal structures, different regulatory structures. I think Herstatt probably set the stage for a lot of things that came, most certainly gave the impetus to speeding up what was going on with SWIFT and how payment systems and all sorts of global processing has been managed since then.
Now, around this time, something similar was happening in the securities industry, too. They were having what they call the back office and paperwork crisis. Were people at this time aware of the parallels between these different fields?
I think not. Don't forget, when you think back, there was Glass-Steagall in place. So you had the separation between securities and banking. There was a paper crisis all over the place, but I don't think there was too much integration between it. Though I do remember when I was at my interview for Bankers Trust, they were talking about there might be a $10 million share day on the New York Stock Exchange, and how are they ever going to handle something like that. But I think we were pretty much siloed in terms of what was going on at the time. Though there was a paper crisis, and DTCC was formed out of the paper crisis.
Exactly.
And you had the bankers and the securities industry actually work together on the DTCC side of things.
Okay. So in 1978, you left Chase for a little while and went to business school, or did you stay with the company?
I stayed with the company. I was in an executive degree program, and I was trying to balance newly married, going to school, working full-time, and traveling in the Middle East. It was quite a juggling act. And I look back at some of the courses I had, and one was I wrote a paper on corporate governance. Now remember, this was 78 to 80. corporate governance. What was that about? And people asked me, corporate governance, in what course could you possibly have done anything on corporate governance? I said, ethics. Mm-hmm. You took an ethics course in the late 70s.
Didn't know ethics and history back then in business. Okay. So you went to business school, but then in 1981, you changed departments within Chase, and you went to the trust department.
Yes, right? But before we get to that, okay, I think one of the things was we were talking about globalization and how mm-hmm. things were moving. And I was in international institutional and did a lot of work in Europe, in Asia. We were setting up, if you want, money transfer regional offices all over the world so that we could be working locally in the local time zone, in the local language, and mm-hmm. be able to deal with things when New York might be closed. So I was traveling a lot. And David Rockefeller had actually sent out a memo saying that the Rafidane Bank in Iraq was looking for some help in automating their mm-hmm. systems. Not having been in the Army, I never knew you shouldn't volunteer, and I wrote back a response, and the next thing I know, I was in Iraq working with the Rafidane Bank, trying to automate some of their DDA systems. At the time, our check systems were not online. They were not real-time at all, and what you'd do is you'd get a printout, and the next morning the teller would have a long sheet, and you'd come in to cash a check, and they'd look to see if you had enough money in your checking account. So when I explained this to those in Baghdad, they didn't really want to automate because they had their own little NCR cards that they could put in, and they updated them real time with a card that they put into a machine. But it was a fascinating time. I was there for about three weeks and mm-hmm. dealt with the central bank. And
what year was that?
Oh, I guess it was 78 or 79.
Okay. So it was right before the war broke out there.
Yes. Saddam Hussein had just sort of, the Ba'ath Party had started mm-hmm. coming into power at the time.
Right.
But it was an interesting time to be there as a woman, mm-hmm. as an American, and a different part of the world than was normally traveled.
Okay. So you traveled in the Middle East and in Europe?
Yeah, and in Asia.
Oh,
in
Asia also.
Yeah. Okay. So I was in Hong Kong, in Singapore, Bahrain. I couldn't get into Saudi Arabia because mm-hmm. I was considered chattel. I was an unescorted woman. And Kuwait.
Mm. So that must have kept you quite busy at the time.
Yes, a lot of travel.
Is that what's behind that? What was behind the move to the Trust Department?
Yes, the opportunity came up. I had been traveling an incredible amount of time. Things were changing. You had 401k accounts being set up, and the Trust Department was domestic. Of course, the area that I got to run was the West Coast. An interesting story. We had landed, and I guess it was a Thursday or Friday, and we were driving to the hotel, and I was with a colleague, and I looked up, and there was a movie playing, and I said, "Oh, great, there's an English language movie." He looked at me, and then I realized the number of times that I'd been in Germany on Frankfurt over a weekend, mm-hmm. and finding something that was in the English language is really key.
Uh-huh. That's funny. Yeah. Okay, so after spending less than a year there in the Trust Department, you went back to Bankers Trust.
Yes.
All right. How did that move happen?
Bankers Trust recruited me. They were automating a lot of systems now. One of the systems that they were in the process of automating was a loan system.
Mm-hmm.
And up until then, loan systems were basically what's the interest rate. But now they were designing a system that had to be able to handle fees and not just interest calculations. And it was a whole change. It was doing complete international, their international loans, their domestic loans, their offshore loans.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been a problem in the reconcilement of the system. And some of the clerks were told, once you work on the system, you don't have to reconcile anything. It's done automatically. Mm-hmm. Well, they never checked the balances.
Ooh.
And the accounts were out by billions of dollars in a gross amount. And they needed someone to come in and get this thing straightened out. It was quite serious because they weren't certain whether the auditors would sign off because it was a material change. So I went over there. It was a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And we did straighten out the system and get it all.
So you had people going back and looking through all the paperwork?
Going back, going through all the paperwork, trying to trying to track it. I worked very, very closely with the internal and the external auditors, as well as the systems people and the operations staff, as well as running a department at the time.
Right. So how long did you spend there at Bankers Trust?
Well, I was at Bankers Trust, I guess, for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then I got a call from someone who was, actually two people were on the board of First Women's Bank. And they said, we'd really like to take you to lunch and have a conversation about the First Women's Bank and how it's doing, and if you have any suggestions, you're in banking, and, could you come on over? And I said, fine, and we had lunch, and they started talking about some of the problems they had. Their operating procedures were weak at best. They were not doing well with money. They needed to raise more capital. And I sat and we talked, and I was giving them suggestions, just sort of free form. And I recall, just as the waiter was bringing the bill, one of them turned to me and said, would you like to become our president and CEO? Well, number one, I hadn't realized that it was an interview. Number two, I hadn't even thought about it, and it's a good thing the waiter had disrupted things with the bill, so I had a chance to think through. So I thought about it, and this was an opportunity to not only run a company, but First Women's Bank was a public company at the time, and it had been formed, I guess, in 1975. It was actually an outgrowth of the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. And if you think back, prior to 1974, when it was the Federal Equal Credit Act was passed, women could not have their own credit. My sister actually made more money than her husband. They both went to apply for a loan in probably 73, and her income was discounted because she'd naturally become pregnant and stay at home. And this was actually legal. Mm-hmm. So it was the first bank in the country that was run by women, for women, and it was trying to cater to the needs of women, both as depositors, borrowers, and business people.
Now, it had a special legal status as a minority bank, right?
It was a minority bank, which meant that 50% of the board, 50% of the staff, and I'm not certain if it had to be with the lending too, had to be to minorities.
Did that give it any advantages in terms of its business model, tax advantages or anything?
Probably gave it some disadvantages. Yeah. There were no tax advantages, but Treasury would sometimes leave deposits at the bank, and I think why I said it was a disadvantage, the bank was so caught up in its minority mission status that it was not functioning as a real financial institution. And I used to say the best way that you can make a mark is to be the most successful small bank, and P.S., it's run by women. And that would really put us in the forefront. A lot of work had to be done at the time, new operating procedures, new capital to be raised. The income was around zero. I think I got it up to $299,000. I remember that number because $300,000 would have been so wonderful. But it was such a small bank. I had come from a large bank. It was about my second week there. And I called the CFO and I said, we've got a $250,000 overdraft. Mm-hmm. And she said, what? And she came running in. Well, it was a $250 overdraft, which they actually sent to the president of the bank. Wow. I was so used to the zeros being omitted, I had just added them on. It was a bank that had its issues, and eventually, while I was the banking superintendent, I closed the bank. It was, I actually recused myself from going on, but it was... It didn't have enough capital. It was competing in a New York market. Its original sense of purpose probably didn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Other banks were catering to women and unique market segments. Though I do remember in 1985 running the annual meeting, and I was pregnant. So it's probably the first pregnant CEO of a public company, if you look back in the archives.
That's pretty impressive. And then while you were pregnant, you actually switched jobs, too.
I did. I was working at the bank, And I got a call from the banking superintendent. We were regulated by New York State. And he was moving to another job and asked if I could see him. Well, the banking superintendent, you don't say, no, I don't want to see you. And I went down and we had a conversation, and he said that he would be moving on. They were looking for a banking superintendent, and would I be interested? Well, I knew my contract would be up in another 6 months or so. I thought I had gotten the bank on fairly good footing in terms of getting systems in, some mm-hmm. procedures in, having us with a steady income. And I said, well, let's talk about it. And the next thing I knew, it was a Saturday, I went down to the World Trade Center and walked into a room, and there were about 12 people sitting around the table. What was even more bizarre was my husband had driven me down, and they had him sit in the room. Try having an interview with your spouse sitting there. Fortunately, he was not in my eye, but some of the political staff from the governor's office. Mm-hmm. It was his appointment secretary. It was the banking superintendent, mm-hmm. and they talked and talked and talked and talked. And I went away for the weekend and came back, and a few days later, they asked if I would come up to Albany and meet with the governor.
Who was governor at that time?
Governor Cuomo, Mario. Mm-hmm. At the time, somehow it never dawned on me that I was the candidate. I just thought, oh, well, to go up and meet the governor, why not? Mm-hmm. That's great. Don't ask me where my head was, that I wasn't thinking the governor wasn't going to meet the top 10 contenders for the job. And as I was sitting there waiting to go in to see him, I can remember somebody saying, who's that? And they said, oh, that's the candidate for the superintendent slot. That, I think, was the first time I'd ever focused on it. I had no idea of what the salary was, what the real job was, what was doing in the department. And I went in and met with the governor. We had a very good conversation. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he said to me, well, you know, you need to make full disclosure. I didn't know that he was talking about financial disclosure. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, if I need to make full disclosure, I'm a Republican. He was a Democrat. I'm a banker. They'd never had a banker running the banking department. They were mm-hmm. afraid of conflicts. And I'm pregnant.
Did he know you were pregnant at the time?
No, no. And he said, I don't want to hear enough anymore. Then he said to me, shh, be quiet. And he picked up the phone and he called his appointment secretary. And he said, I just finished speaking to Jill Considine. Did any of you offer her a job? And they all thought, uh-oh, he's not happy with her. And he said, no, nobody offered her a job. No, we just told her you were coming up. And he says, well, I'm glad no one made the offer because I want to. And he hung up, and then he offered me the job.
Oh, that's good.
Of course, I had to be confirmed by the Senate, right. And there was a fairly long process. So mm-hmm. my unknown pregnancy became more and more known.
Right.
And I was sworn in when I was about 7 months pregnant.
All right, well. There's a story about you having an assistant bringing documents to the delivery room for you to sign.
Yes, the banking department was started in 1847, I think, and mm-hmm. some of the rules were quite arcane, mm-hmm. Had never contemplated computers, let alone faxes, mm-hmm. or telephones for that matter. And the superintendent, if the superintendent were in New York State, needed to sign all the documents. And I had given birth, and the next day in the hospital I was signing off on various regulations.
So did you come into office with any particular priorities? Or?
Well, this was the time of deregulation, international expansion, and as I was being sworn in, you had the S&L crisis in Maryland mm-hmm. and Ohio. There were falling real estate values. Oh, we've heard that before. The Tax Reform Act of 1986 had created some havoc. The savings banks had a mismatched book. Mm-hmm. They were lending long, borrowing short. Interest rates were going up. They had fixed loans. Reg Q, which had set the mm-hmm. The standard in terms of what right. interest rates could be charged, was disappearing. As a matter of fact, there was a wonderful rule at the time. It was called the 3-6-3 rule. to be a successful banker. And it was, you take in deposits at 3%, lend them out at 6%, and be on the golf course by 3 p.m. And wow, that whole world was totally, totally changing. Mm-hmm. You had the S&L crisis. The savings banks and the savings and loans were under Garn St. Germain, mm-hmm, were given new capabilities,
right,
that they could, new powers that they could use. They did not know how to use them. They were mutuals, mm-hmm, so they had no way of getting in new capital. It was a very, very difficult time that went on.
Was that something that was on your radar from the moment you took office, or was
no, no?
Okay.
It was the S&L crisis, but it was the S&L crisis in Maryland and Ohio, oh, yeah, and who thought it would ever hit where we were? We had several iconic savings banks fail. I think the first one I had to close was in the fall of 1985. Mm-hmm. It was the Bowery Savings Bank.
Right.
And the Bowery Savings Bank had been around for 100 and probably 150, 60 mm-hmm years. And it was just a very, very sad, sad time. As a matter of fact, Cipriani, mm-hmm, on 42nd Street is the old Bowery Bank. And whenever I go to a reception or a dinner there, there's still the teller cages around, and it brings a very, very sad feeling because it was a very difficult time in banking.
Was there any thought given to rescuing some of these banks at the time?
Oh, there were rescues, yes. Mm-hmm. They were handed, they were merged, mm-hmm, with other banks.
Right.
And then the other banks would take on a bank that had problems and would create a larger bank failure. The FDIC was actually the insurer, the savings banks, and they would be the ones that would work out any of the failing banks.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Seidman was actually the head of the FDIC at the time. And I remember I used to say, I guess enough time has passed that it's okay. I used to say, okay, let's prepare the Dear Bill letter. And they'd say, what's that? And we would actually then hand over the bank, and they would close it down. It would be, Dear Bill, please kill, love, Jill. Sort
wow
of sad, and it was very sad to, uh-huh, to sign some of those because the institutions had been around for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
We actually passed a law that allowed mutual institutions to demutualize and go out into the capital markets. The other thing that was an advantage is the banking department was very large, and we regulated savings banks, savings, mm-hmm, and loans, commercial banks, international banks, credit unions. And I did a shake-up in the department,
right,
and put those who had formerly run the commercial banks into,
mm-hmm,
the savings and savings and loans,
right,
because they were getting the powers that the commercial banks had. So you didn't want to have a regulator who didn't know what was going on as well as an institution. And we moved a lot of the examiners around, which I think helped a lot in terms of trying to stem the
right
flow.
So you had this financial crisis going on in savings and loans, and then you were also starting these initiatives to deregulate certain aspects,
correct,
of the
correct
banking industry. For you, was the financial crisis an argument for deregulation?
Yeah, I think so. One of the problems was, and let's talk about Glass-Steagall in particular, because
right, exactly,
that had been talked about on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And you had foreign competition that was going on. There was general deregulation going on in the financial markets anyhow. Diversification
right
was an issue. And Glass-Steagall, of course, had been passed in, 1933. Mm-hmm. I think part of it was Reg Q. I think they also established the FDIC. So
yep,
that Glass-Steagall was known as, but there was an awful lot of
right
things that happened under it.
Glass-Steagall was the federal law. And there was
that was
something
federal law.
Similar in the
and
state
in
of
New
York
York, there was a similar law, which was called Mini-Glass-Steagall,
mm-hmm,
Section 103, I think it was. Well, Bankers Trust and J.P. Morgan were two banks that J.P. Morgan was very much in sort of towards the investment side, and Bankers Trust had gotten rid of its retail banking. And the two banks came and said, we're afraid that if Glass-Steagall is taken away, that we'll be hampered by New York banks' law. So can you do a ruling on that? And we looked and we looked, and it all hinged on principally engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And what does principally engaged mean? So I thought about it. Well, if you're not doing anything, you're not principally engaged. If you're more than 50%, you're principally engaged. So we wrote the ruling that if it were less than 50%, you would not be principally engaged. Right. But we did not want the banks to get into this wholesale. So first we said 10% of revenue, and it could go up to 25% of revenue. Well, that was the first, I guess, hammer against the Glass-Steagall wall. And that then became the model for what the Fed eventually did.
Right.
And I think that was in 1988.
Right. And Glass-Steagall was repealed essentially 11 years later.
So it was
quite a bit ahead of your time.
Yeah, but it allowed the baby steps for the banks to get into. I have to say the securities industry was not happy at all because there was a means for the banks to get into the investment side of business. There was not actually a good route for the
insurance industry was a little upset about some things too. Right?
Oh,
like
yes.
Annuities?
Yes, annuities.
What happened there?
Under banking law, the banking law authorized banks to engage in business that was incidental to banking. And we thought that having fixed and variable annuities was something that would be incidental to banking. It made a lot of sense and actually allowed the banks to offer these products. P.S. That wound up in many, many, many lawsuits with the insurance agents.
Went all the way to the Supreme Court.
And it was upheld. So there were. I mean, looking back at the time, you didn't have interstate banking. The state banks had an incredible amount of authority. We were the primary regulators for international banks. As a matter of fact, I was known as the second largest regulator of Japanese banks after the Bank of Japan. And a lot of the rulings that we made actually set the standard for what would happen on a national level. It was sort of considered to be a laboratory of innovation that could be tried out in the local markets and then see how it went. At the time, not only was there not interstate banking, there was not intrastate banking. And you couldn't have a bank in a contiguous county. And this was to protect the smaller local banks from the large money center banks.
Right. Just to go back to annuities for just a second. Was that something that you came up with at the banking department, or did a bank come and ask you all to allow them to sell annuities? Or is that just too fine? Do you remember that?
You know what? There was a lot of conversation going on at the time.
Right. Okay.
Can banks get into insurance? Can banks get into annuities? What can going on? So there would be always conversations with the bankers, the savings and loan, the savings banks, with all the different associations in terms of what would be going on. And we'd look at things and say, what makes sense? What is safe and sound? And move from there. Speaking of safe and sound, I think another issue in terms of deregulation that occurred was the Bank of New York Irving situation. And you had never had a hostile takeover of a large bank. I think maybe there might have been some small ones. And the Bank of New York made a hostile bid for Irving. And Irving thought that they would be protected by the courts and the regulators and so on. But as it turned out, we were called to opine on this.
Right.
I remember getting over 2,000 letters, mostly from Irving employees.
Right.
I was called up by our senators from New York, by the governor, by lots of different people because they were being pressured. And my point was, if it's safe and sound, and we will opine on that, then it's up for the shareholders to decide.
Right.
It is not for a banking department to prevent commerce.
Right.
Well, I think that was probably startling at the time, at least to Irving. I think they thought we were going to protect them. And it went before the banking board, which I chaired. And it was a very difficult vote because we needed to have a quorum. Well, we needed to have a set number of votes. It might have been 12. I can't remember.
Right.
Some of the seats were not filled. They were not excluded from the vote at the time.
People just didn't show up because they didn't want to vote on it?
No, they were not filled. They have to be appointed and approved.
I see.
So they were open seats.
Right.
there was a clearing bank mm-hmm. member. He had to recuse himself because how could he vote for one clearing bank versus the other clearing
right.
bank? There was a savings and loan or a savings bank that had an investment from Irving there. He had to recuse himself. And we went through this. And when it came time for the vote, we had had a private conversation, then we were going to have the public meeting. I wasn't certain if we had the votes.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to the people on the banking board, I said, you better be prepared mm-hmm. to explain to the press why you defeated this. Yeah. We've put in a couple of thousand hours looking at the safety and soundness mm-hmm. and what it is that you feel you know better mm-hmm. of why it shouldn't go to a shareholder vote. Some of the members were actually union members, and some of them represented political groups. It was a very difficult time, but
right.
we actually did allow that to happen. So during that time, there was incredible deregulation that was going on. Interstate
mm-hmm.
banking occurred. The S&L crisis. Fiducia actually got passed at the tail end of it.
Mm-hmm.
We ruled on Glass-Steagall, annuities as being banking products. And I had a very close relationship with the Japanese banks because
mm-hmm.
there were tons of Japanese banks
right.
in the U.S. at the time. And I actually became a fellow of the Japan Society and spent, I guess, about 3 months in Japan working with the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan
mm-hmm.
and actually running my office from
right.
Japan and finding out more about the Japanese banks.
This is a time when some people were very concerned about the Japanese taking over.
They were very, very concerned.
Not the global economy, but, surpassing the United
yes.
States.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm trying to remember. I think IBJ bought Schroeder,
mm-hmm.
and Schroeder was a primary dealer in U.S. securities, and I had to approve that transaction.
Was there much pushback against that because people were worried about foreign banks?
Oh, my gosh, pushback. I had the Fed calling me, Corrigan screaming at me, Schumer screaming at me, everybody yelling at me because they did not want a foreign institution being a primary dealer in U.S. securities.
Right.
But people weren't getting that the world was changing.
Mm-hmm.
It was globalizing, and there was competition out there. And we had to make certain that things were safe and sound. But if we didn't move, the U.S. could have been marginalized.
So at this time, there were a lot of interesting things happening with credit cards, right?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, a lot of the states had usury laws and ceilings set on how much a
mm-hmm.
credit card could offer. And there was some talk about repealing that in New York State. And the feeling up in Albany was, well, why do we need to repeal anything? The banks are here. They're brick and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
They can't move anywhere. And then Citibank moved to South Dakota, which had no usury laws, and issued their credit cards from there. So it became a competitive issue. It became a jobs issue. You had deregulation coming on one side.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, I needed to protect the consumer. We did a series of public service announcements
mm-hmm.
where I would get up and talk about credit cards, talk about there being variable rates, and that you should shop around.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to come on just before the 10 o'clock news every
American
night,
television.
And I was on TV, and I was known as the shop-around girl.
Wow.
And sometimes I'd be shopping, and someone said, oh, there's the shop-around girl. I was actually the New York State banking superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
But part of our goal was not just trying to manage deregulation, safety, and soundness,
mm-hmm.
but also dealing with the consumers. We established a consumer hotline and tried to educate the consumers as
mm-hmm.
much as possible, as well as starting financial education in the high schools.
Did your daughter see you on TV as the chaperone girl?
You know, she probably did, but she was so little at the time that it probably didn't make any difference to her.
Right.
I should see if I can find one of those old tapes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So in 1991, after 5 years as the chief banking regulator in the state of New York, you
right.
decided to leave.
Right. It was time. It's an appointed position.
Mm-hmm.
Things had done well. I think we were in a steady state environment. I was concerned about going to any bank which I had regulated.
Was there a law that would have
there was a law
that?
If I had been a lawyer,
mm.
but not as
right.
a non-lawyer. I just thought that I could never go to Bank of New York.
No.
I could never go to J.P. Morgan. Mm-hmm. I could never...
you would have seen that as a conflict.
I would have seen that as a conflict. And although Bankers Trust, I know, was interested in hiring me back, and that was sort of my home base, if you want, mm-hmm. I just felt it just wouldn't look right.
So you ended up at American Express Bank.
American Express Bank. Now, American Express Bank was actually chartered in Connecticut, I think, in 1919. And it could only do banking outside of the United States.
Oh.
It was sort of an odd duck. But it provided services to financial institutions, high net worth individuals, and affluent customers all over the world. Mm-hmm. It was in 72 locations in, I think, 45 different countries. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a presence, particularly in Asia and in the subcontinent.
Okay.
And I did a lot of traveling at the time.
Mm-hmm. What was your position there?
I was the chief administrative officer mm-hmm. of the bank,
right.
And also sat on the board of American Express Bank
okay.
International. Two interesting stories. One, we actually handled the bank accounts mm-hmm. for the Vatican in Rome, and we went to Rome to meet with there were actually some cardinals, but they were the financial experts there. And when we were finished with our financial meetings, we were given a tour of the Sistine Chapel. And it was just two of us and the head of the Swiss Guard. Now, if you've ever been to the Sistine Chapel, you get through in about 37 seconds and there are 3,000 people standing behind you. We were in there for 2 hours and pointing out who this one was and which of the Borgias that one was. It was fascinating. And I thought, this has got to be the high point of my trip to the Vatican. And we walked outside and we were standing on the plaza there and someone said something and I laughed. And one of the guards came running over and said to me, "Shh, Papa Dormi," and he pointed up. It meant the Pope is sleeping, and I was standing under his window. And I think that probably was my high point at the Vatican, that I was so close that my laugh could have awakened the Pope.
Wow.
And then the other one, this was at the time, now remember, Eastern Europe was going through incredible changes. Mm-hmm. And you had Czechoslovakia splitting into the Czech Republic and the Slovak, and you had tremendous changes, freedom all over, and new banking systems mm-hmm. Coming about. They had been socialized, trying to establish stock exchanges, trying to open up private banks. Mm-hmm. And we went to meet with the head of the central bank in the Czech Republic, in Prague. And I was told for 2 weeks before we get there, remember, this is the Czech Republic located in Central Europe. They will be very insulted if you say Czechoslovakia, Eastern Europe. And I practiced this because I was so afraid that I would insult someone. And we got there, and I said, "Thank you so much for inviting us here, and we're here to see if there's anything we can do to help you with banking services." And the head of the central bank, his name was Joseph Chusky, and I still see him, and he and I chuckle over this. I said, "Thank you very much." And he said, "Well, we here in Czechoslovakia in Eastern Europe," and I burst out laughing. And everyone turned to look at me, and I said, "I have to tell you that I have been practicing for weeks now to say the Czech Republic in Central Europe." And he said, "Yes, but after all these years, I still think about it in Czechoslovakia in Eastern Europe."
Wow.
It was a time where globalization was really mm-hmm. occurring, and a lot of travel.
You got to see that on your travels.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, around this time, there was also a very interesting op-ed published in the New York Times by yourself, in which you suggested making New York an autonomous city-state, like Hong Kong.
Oh, yes.
Or Singapore.
Yes, oh, yes. I had forgotten about that.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Was this just an idea that had come to you and you thought it was worth writing a
piece about? Yes, I do. You know, that's very interesting. I had totally forgotten about that. I'm going to have to ask you to send me that article. Yes, but New York is really pretty much a city-state like Hong Kong or Shanghai. And it seemed to be the appropriate thing to do at the time. Actually, another idea that I had that I went to, I spoke to some people in Washington when we still had the issue of Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
My idea was to have banks set up on Indian reservations because they weren't under federal law for mm-hmm. Glass-Steagall.
Right.
And I actually spoke to someone who was on the Fed who had actually once been at the Department of the Interior. And we played with that idea for a while, too.
Yeah, you're getting somebody a good, good business idea right now. So. All right, but you stayed in American Express less than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then you moved on to the New York Clearinghouse Association. How did you end up in that position?
Headhunter called me, mm-hmm. and it was sort of, I don't want to say coming home, but the New York Clearinghouse is such an icon in New York. Mm-hmm. it had been founded in 1853. It was the oldest association and payments company in the United States. It was the members were the clearing banks, mm-hmm. in New York. It was established before you had the Fed, before you had the FDIC, mm-hmm. and it was actually established because if one bank had a problem, it could spill over to all the other banks.
Right.
And it actually went in, and this is prior to my time coming there, like prior to the Fed. It would go in and it would audit the member banks. If a member bank had a shortfall, they could make loans so that there wouldn't be a lack of money for the depositors to take. It did check clearing, mm-hmm. And set up all sorts of banking services. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when the Fed came, it no longer had to take care of some of these issues, but it was there during several financial panics,
mm-hmm. and including 1987.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, and there are photos, not photos, paintings of I think the 1907 panic, and J.P. Morgan was a person who was very involved in working some of that out. So it was a fascinating organization. It had a building stone that had been moved from its original building, and I used to call it the Begat Stone because there was the Chemical and the Corn Exchange and the Chase and the Manhattan and the Morgan and the Guarantee, and I'm trying to remember what the others were, but I used to say, and they begat J.P. Morgan Chase.
Right.
And you could just see all of the banks in New York that had merged in, mm-hmm. In that stone from about 1897. But what was run by the New York Clearinghouse at the time were some payment and clearance systems, and for cash, and one was called CHIPS, which did about $2 trillion a day. And these were large value payments that were the result of banking transactions, mm-hmm. a lot of foreign exchange,
right.
and they came through the mm-hmm. the clearinghouse. There was also an association that was made up of the chairman of the clearing banks.
Mm-hmm.
So once a month, the chairman of Chase and J.P. Morgan and Bank of New York and Chemical and Manny mm-hmm. Hanny and
right.
would all meet in the clearinghouse.
So this was kind of an informal place where they could talk about the problems.
We talk about issues that were germane to banking, mm-hmm. that were of common interest. We would file amicus briefs.
Right.
We would write comment letters. It was a wonderful place. If you looked at it, the walls were all mahogany and
right.
hung with the pictures of those who had led the clearinghouse before.
Okay. Just real quickly, just to take a step back.
Sure.
While you were a banking regulator, did you have much contact with the Clearinghouse Association?
Yes, a lot.
Okay.
A lot of times they would be coming in talking about various banking issues, mm-hmm. interstate banking. So I knew of the Clearinghouse from
yeah.
My days as the banking regulation.
Did you actually regulate the Clearinghouse or the
no,
systems?
No,
okay.
no. And I also knew of it when I was at Chase. I did
mm-hmm.
the SWIFT to CHIPS interface.
Right.
So I had a relationship there. It was sort of, oh, it's all coming back home again.
Okay.
So it was quite interesting to me.
Was there an interview process for the job, or did they just offer it to you?
There was an interview process. I had to meet with some of the chairmen of the various clearing banks.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably at an advantage over my competitors in that I had regulated some of those chairmen.
Right.
So I was not as overwhelmed by the presence. Though I must say, when you got 12 of the chairman CEOs of the major clearing banks
mm-hmm.
gathered together in a room, the amount of brain power that was available and knowledge about banking
mm-hmm.
was just quite extraordinary. And the chairman by the time I got there, David Rockefeller and John McGillicuddy had already retired. But I used to meet with David Rockefeller and John McGillicuddy because they would talk about their days at the clearinghouse and the things that that went on and the discussions that happened.
Mm-hmm. So while you were there, the organization underwent a number of structural changes. Did you go into your job with a plan to change the organization?
No.
At all?
No. Okay. But I get in there and I see things and I want to make them right.
Right. Okay.
And once again, we were now doing interstate banking.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of changes that were going on. It was the New York Clearinghouse, but the world was no longer New York. You had international banks. You had, I guess, Marine Midland had been bought by HSBC. Mm-hmm. Deutsche Bank bought Bankers Trust. Suddenly, you didn't have the New York banks sitting at the table.
Right.
And it became an issue of how do we move forward?
Mm-hmm.
Do we expand ourselves domestically and let in a Bank of America? Or do we look internationally, because there are an awful lot of international users on the chip side? Well, there were issues in terms of who used what services, where the risk was. And although the association, CHIPS, the ACH, and CHECS had all been one organization, we talked about it a lot and decided that what we should do is spin off into three separate companies. And one would be CHIPS, one would be the CHECS, it was called. I think now it's called SVPCO, and it does image exchange of the CHECS. And the other one was the Electronic Payments Network, which did ACH. The reason for the spinoff was you isolated the risk, but you also allowed people to join the various associations and be members and not associates based on what products they were using. And then the then, of course, the members at the Clearinghouse Association started having more and more of the foreign bankers sitting at the table. One of the suggestions I had brought up was, why not make the Clearinghouse Association a global association, or why not allow the Goldman Sachs's and the Morgan Stanley and the Merrill's to come part of it and talk about New York and what we wanted to do as a financial center.
Right.
So there were all sorts of opportunities there.
There are different ideas being thrown around. Was there any pushback to this idea of spinning off the companies and looking abroad more globally?
Yes. there was always pushback.
Uh-huh.
Some of the banks really liked the idea of bringing in a Goldman Sachs and a Morgan Stanley because Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, and J.P. Morgan at the time, that would have been people that they would have liked to associate with. The sort of Citibanks at the time would really like to discuss more of the retail banking sides of things. So which way we were going to go was a lot of argument back and forth. Also, we've been around since 1853. Are we going to be changing how we do things? But it made a lot of sense, and then each of the organizations was able to grow. I think probably we cleared and settled $2 trillion a day, and a lot of paper coming through the CHECS and the ACH, but the dollar volume was coming through CHIPS, and you wanted to have that really isolated.
Did you have to negotiate these plans with regulators at all? Were they interested in it, or did you feel like you had a free hand?
Well, we weren't a regulated entity.
Right.
However, since we did final settlement through the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, we talked a lot with the Federal Reserve in terms of how things were going. There was also at the time a big concern about what was going on in large value payment systems, so they were called, and what the risk would be brought to the system if a bank would fail, or if a country would fail, and we ran lots of models to find out, could we cover if any individual bank or any, we could cover any individual bank failure, we could cover a lot of country failures, we could cover multiple country failures, we could not cover if the United States failed, if the UK failed, if Switzerland failed, and I think if Germany failed.
And then we started working on what do we do now, and came up with all sorts of schemes that had to do with prepayment and making the system absolutely secure and robust.
So a lot of your work dealt with the system side and the technical side, making sure that everything works.
Systems, technical side, but on the other hand, dealing with what the issues were in banking. Mm-hmm. Once again, coming together, it was my SWIFT and CHIPS technical background, but it was also the New York State Banking Department with issues and deregulation, filing amicus briefs, thought leadership. The clearinghouse functioned with a series of committees, and some of the committees would deal with money transfers. Some of them would deal with deregulation. Some of them would deal with Federal Reserve issues. Mm-hmm. And we would write papers and have groups come together and discuss the best way to have these things taken care of. Since its founding, DTC had a seat for the clearinghouse, mm-hmm. and I was serving as the clearinghouse director,
right.
and attended the board meetings from, I guess, 1991, mm-hmm. when I first went over to the clearinghouse. So I was quite familiar with DTC.
And the different issues that they were facing.
And the different issues that they were facing,
right. uh-huh.
at the time. And it came to be, I guess, 1998. And Bill Janicki was retiring, and we were going to be looking for a successor. And I went on the search committee.
Wow, convenient.
As co-chair. Right. And actually, my co-chair, I thought, would make a wonderful head of DTC. And I spoke to him about it, and he was very interested. I won't mention the company he was with, but they wouldn't let him go because of Y2K, and
right.
He would have left too much in options, et cetera, right. on the table. But because of that, the fact that he was going to be a potential candidate, mm-hmm. I gave most of the presentations to the board in terms of the search and how we were going. And as we were interviewing candidates, Ed Goldberg was on the committee, who was the head of operations at Merrill Lynch, John Thain from Goldman Sachs, was it Steve Elliott from Mellon? We had quite a crew. And we did the interviews over at the New York Clearinghouse so that you wouldn't see candidates walking in and out of DTCC. And we had interviewed probably 20 candidates in person. And at one point I went and I said, "Well, I don't know. I just don't get it. They don't seem to understand what's happening out there. They don't understand the globalization. They don't understand how critical technology is, the competition that's really out there." And I just went into a little bit of a tirade. And I can't remember who it was, turned and said, "Well, why don't you, interview for the position?" And I thought they were being sarcastic. And I said, okay. I said, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, but I'm a little frustrated in terms of what we're finding." And they said, no, we really mean it. And I said, let me think about that. And I went home and I thought about it for the weekend. And I came back and I said, okay, mm-hmm. but I'm going to have to recuse myself from anything now.
Right.
And when the interview came, I actually switched seats and moved to the interview seat. Mm-hmm. And I was hired.
Right.
Now, at the time, what was going on? Everybody was exercised about Y2K. We thought that might be the end of the world as we knew it at the time.
So people were taking it very seriously.
Taking it incredibly seriously. Mm-hmm. Hiring programmers, rewriting mm-hmm. systems, making certain that we had the right dates in place, testing.
And it was
testing,
a real
testing.
Threat, you know.
Yes, it was a real threat and a big concern. If you were a retail and someone went and mm-hmm. Bought a shirt and it came out with the wrong date on the receipt, well, but if we couldn't get our infrastructure to
right.
function, we'd have a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
I had completed the Y2K work at CHIPS, so I was quite familiar with what was going on. A lot of it was underway mm-hmm. at DTCC, and now we were at the point that we were testing with our members. Another issue that was there was how we could integrate DTC and NSCC. So
mm-hmm.
you had the depository and the clearing corporation.
So that was already under discussion.
It was under discussion mainly because a lot of the senior people in the industry were frustrated mm-hmm. that you had two organizations that had duplicative human resources, financial.
Tell me a little bit about the relationship between the two. I mean, you guys were next door neighbors, but.
We were next door neighbors, but DTC's. Think about the things at the time. We still had Glass-Steagall in place. The DTC was more on the bank side, custodian banks. There were broker-dealers, but it was more on a banking side, whereas when you got to the NSCC, it was broker-dealers. Mm-hmm. And very, very different corporate cultures. No one wanted to give up their prevalence. The board members didn't want to be subsumed. You had a board member from mm-hmm. Goldman on one, a board member from Goldman on the other, who was going to be the board member. Plus, they were very concerned with Y2K coming. Mm-hmm. The last thing they wanted to do was disrupt the infrastructure. And this had been talked about for a really long time. Neither one of the organizations had actually made much headway in trying mm-hmm. to be global. Each one would start something, and it would sort of fall apart.
But there had been a few efforts?
There had been efforts, and they'd all sputtered right. and failed. And it's just natural competition, and okay. nobody likes a merger.
All right. So is it fair to say that that pressure from the participants is what finally led to the merger? Or?
Well, I think the pressure from the participants, they'd been talking about it for a long time. Uh-huh. I came on board, and I was a new kid on the block. Mm-hmm. You were going to be having both of the sitting CEOs were getting near to the retirement age, mm-hmm. so that would take care of an issue in terms right. of who's going to be running the combined companies, mm-hmm. because personalities and right. personal issues. And I was the new kid on the block, so uh-huh. I didn't have any history
right.
in terms of animosities that mm-hmm. that might have existed at the time.
Okay. So when was the ink signed on the merger? I mean, what did it happen before you took over in
January
1999 or afterwards?
Well, no, it mm-hmm. Happened after right. I came on board. Mm-hmm. I guess probably in the spring of 99.
Okay.
Dave Kelly announces retirement in October of 99. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to get through Y2K, but we started combining... Mm-hmm. Finance and human resources and corporate communications.
Right. You came into your position in January 1999, and then I understand you had a 100-day plan.
Yes, yes. Well, I had a 100-day plan, and there was a lot of reasons for the 100-day plan. Part of it was that when you do a merger, people are just hanging out at the water cooler trying to figure out who's got what political advantage, mm-hmm. and no one is really concentrating. Mm-hmm. Plus, I think both organizations, being a monopoly in their own right, mm-hmm. had no clue as to the competition that was out there. And our competition was international. Mm-hmm. Our competition was the fact that we had a utility mentality. We were slow to market on things. Mm-hmm. Our competition was actually some of our members, board members, shareholders could come up with systems that might have been good for them. It might have been not best for the common good. I used to say to my board, we have a natural conflict. My goal is to drive inefficiency out of the system. Your goal is to make profit on the inefficiencies in the system. But it was, and I mean, that is the nature of an organization such as that. So we needed to really change our mindset. We held a series of town hall meetings, mm-hmm. and I talked about the changes that were going on in the world, the globalization, how technology was moving international, that our competition was now on a global basis. And I actually spoke to every single employee in the company with town hall meetings. And at the time, not every employee had a computer, but we had kiosks. Think back. I see you raising your eyebrows. Yes, not every employee had a computer, but we had kiosks with email. And I said, email me any comments, and I will get back to you. And I remember one of the staff sent me an email and said, Ms. Considine, I understand what you've said. We either change or we die. Hmm. And I took that email and I said, he gets it. Hmm. Do you? And a lot of my staff didn't. They weren't happy about the merger. They were used to where they were. I remember them saying to me, well, what do you want us to be? Do you want us to be safe and reliable, mm-hmm. or do you want us to be innovating? And I said, I want you to do both. And it was a matter of getting people focused. So the 100-day plan was a means of focusing everyone's attention,
right.
changing the culture, mm-hmm. changing the mindset. It was a call to action. Mm-hmm. It was being very, very aggressive. It was drawing a line in the sand. And we set out 10 objectives, I think there were. There was strategic vision. It was global straight-through mm-hmm. processing, right. how we were going to handle that, taking a look at our technology infrastructure mm-hmm. to see whether or not our technology would actually be able to support what our vision was, looking at other products, putting our products on a P&L basis,
right.
having a P&L, having a plan for each of the products, mm-hmm. where they were going to do, putting us into a cost focus mode, putting us into a for-profit mode, even mm-hmm. though we functioned at cost.
Were you also talking to regulators at this time, like the SEC or anyone else, about the plans for the merger? Or
well, yes, because we were regulated by the SEC, the Fed, and New York State Banking Department.
What was that? What was their attitudes towards the merger? Were they behind it 100%, or did they have hesitations?
Well, they asked a lot of good questions uh-huh. about it. They did not want to destroy the infrastructure for the American financial system. On the other hand, they understood that we really needed to get on with it and that we needed to respond to the needs of our customers. Our
mm-hmm.
customers were now moving globally. They were offering more products. There was risk out there that hadn't been accounted for. There was risk in the system that mm-hmm. could not be contained by just one individual banking member.
Okay.
And the other thing, we had a mentality of, you know, the sort of buy versus build mentality.
Mm-hmm.
We would always build it. And that just did not make sense, where you could buy and be to market a
right.
lot faster as you went along.
Okay. And maybe one example of that was DTCC's partnership with Thomson Global.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how that came about, because this was sort of an innovative idea for DTCC.
Well, at the time, we settled T plus three.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, everyone was talking about T plus one. And if we were going to speed up settlement, we needed to have much more straight-through processing. And we were working on it at DTCC, but it had to be done on a global mm-hmm. basis. And there was a group called the Global Straight-Through Processing Association, which got started and got a lot of funding. I think it was 100 million euro or something to get this thing going.
So it was a European association?
Well, it was global,
oh.
but it was a European association. We had actually come in with a bid thinking that we had some ways of making this work, but I think we were probably too American
mm-hmm.
For them. So the Global Straight-Through Processing Association went ahead. It just never got off the ground.
Right.
The markets were not so good when it was ready. People
mm-hmm.
weren't available. They spent all their time on technology without looking at the business,
mm-hmm.
without looking at the marketing, and they just never got started. But while we were looking at this, we and Thomson started talking. Now, Thomson and DTCC had competing products out in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think we used to write nasty letters about one another to the Justice Department.
that's true. I talked to Bill Jenicke about this, and he said that at some point this changed, and DTC
yes.
decided to start supporting.
Well, what happened was people changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I came on board as the CEO, and the part of Thomson that actually dealt with this had a new CEO. P.S., we were both women. And I guess maybe there wasn't as much testosterone in the room. And we started talking about how could we make things better.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with the joint venture. Now, this was joint ventures, number one, usually are not terribly successful. Secondly, we had a at-cost organization that was not public doing a joint venture with a public company
mm-hmm.
that had been fighting one another
right.
for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, this is what we want to do. We want to be able to take the innovation and the competitiveness of the public sector, mm-hmm. the safety and soundness that DTC brings to it, and we've got the customers, mm-hmm. and we had the global footprint.
Right.
And suddenly we were live with 6,000 customers in 40 different countries. That's a business model.
Mm-hmm.
And Omgeo just celebrated its 10th anniversary, and it's growing and going strong.
Mm-hmm. This partnership with the private business shows that the DTC was willing to look at a lot of different experimental ideas. Was there any thought given to changing the structure of the company to a profit-seeking company, or did you always want to keep it the way it is in the sense of returning?
Always wanted to keep it the way it was because the amount of money that we could save the industry.
Mm-hmm.
by investing and innovating was much more than they could ever get from stock returns.
Right.
And I know it looks like, wow, they're making $1.3 billion, they're making $1.4 billion. After the cost, that money would be returned mm-hmm. to the shareholders. And there are some things that you have to do that if you were a for-profit company, I'm not certain if you would be able to do. Business continuity planning, the kind of robustness, the kind of capacity planning that we would do,
right.
it wouldn't have worked. I know it was very tempting to people. They'd look at it. We always would have investment bankers mm-hmm. saying, my gosh, look what you're processing and look what you could do. Some of the things that we did, though, to bring us more into the competitive realm, and this was very key, was to get the AAA rating from S&P.
Mm-hmm.
for DTCC's subsidiaries. This was crucial in a lot of means, not the least of which was saying, we're out there, we can compete,
mm-hmm.
we're respected outside of the wonk world of clearance and settlement.
So that was something you wanted to do from an early date?
Yes, yes.
Right.
It also made our borrowing costs cheaper, but it also was part of saying, we've changed.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer sort of your sleepy utility.
Right.
We're out there, and now we're AAA rated.
Okay. So during this period, DTCC was expanding into many different areas, creating many new subsidiaries, and I want to ask you about some of them in a minute. But first, I'd like to ask you about DTCC's experience and your experience of 9/11.
Oh, 9/11, yeah. That was such a horrendous event. We could see everything from our windows.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a staff meeting at 8:45 that morning, planning for an employee appreciation day. As a matter of fact, one of our staff members was supposed to have been at the World Trade Center at a conference, and I wouldn't let him go because he had to be there for employee appreciation day. I told him he could go in the afternoon. And one of the staff came in and said, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. Well, we were certain that it was, you know, a little Cessna and someone had a heart attack. And then, of course, a few minutes later, the plane came right around our building and hit the second tower. We didn't know what was going on. We were in the midst of everything. There was paper blowing all over downtown Manhattan. And we were open. And we were processing. Because you do T+3, so it was Tuesday. We were clearing
mm-hmm.
Thursday's trades. The markets didn't open that day. We continued to clear and settle and did, I think, $280 billion that day and about $1.8 trillion for the week. We made the decision that we were going to stay open. We dealt with a lot of our institutions, 13 of whom were left
mm-hmm.
homeless. They had been involved in the World Trade Center, and we provided space so that they could do processing. Some of our staff members, it was really a case of ordinary people doing extraordinary
mm-hmm.
things, drove out to New Jersey with modems that they could give to various bankers. And we worked with Cantor Fitzgerald, who
mm-hmm.
had been really wiped out. And they processed their transactions for the U.S. from the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
with help from our U.K. staff who understood the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm. Were you in touch with other people on Wall Street,
We were in touch with the New York Stock Exchange. We were in touch with the White House. We were in touch with the Fed. We were in touch with the New York State Banking Department. We were in touch with the SEC. We were in touch with,
mm-hmm.
with everyone. I do remember that since clearance and settlement is not something that is on the front burner, it probably was about a day or two later that the White House finally called. And they said, how are you doing? Well, I stayed down in DTCC and I slept there for a couple of days. And they said, well, are you going to be able to open? I said, we've never closed. We're open. What we do need, though, is transportation. How are we going to get people down here, especially on Saturday, because we're going to have to deal with some of the paperwork. We have vaults with lots of securities in them. Well, we'll send over the National Guard. I said, that's the last thing I need. They said, well, what can we do for you? I said, well, clean underwear and some bagels would be very But we continue to run. We continue to operate. Mm-hmm. We went to our backup site and continued to operate from there. So mm-hmm. we were never down.
So you already did have backup systems.
Oh, we already had backup systems. As a matter of fact, the problem that we had was telephone service within mm-hmm. New York didn't work, but we could get out.
Right.
So we would call out to people in New Jersey or Long Island mm-hmm. and ask them to call back into New York to convey okay. messages. I actually called Brussels and had the people at SWIFT send out messages mm-hmm. on the SWIFT network to keep everybody posted in terms of what was going on.
How did 9/11 impact DTCC's security and backup planning?
Well, it changed us completely. It changed us completely. Mm-hmm. I looked and realized we had the backup systems, but the backup system was located in Brooklyn. And we were just lucky that it was across the water. Mm-hmm. And I looked at some institutions who had their backup system located in the World Trade Center and their primary system in the World Trade Center, and realized that we needed to have geographic separation, that we were critical. It's not that we were too big to fail. We were something that could not fail. So out of that came a business continuity plan, and some of the things that came out of it were to have a remote data center, not only a backup data center, that would be nearby in case we had to spill over.
Right.
But a remote data center that would be located totally on a different power grid, mm-hmm. you know, thousands
so
of miles away.
So you looked around for location. Campbell was the
around.
Location?
Well, no, we have a secret location.
This is a secret location?
Where the data center
That's
is
right.
located.
Okay.
And that was put off, and it was quite technologically innovative because there was a distance. It has to do with the speed of light in terms of how you could transact and back up. And we got it down to such a point that if we were to lose both our primary and our backup data center, the third one would still be functioning. And they all functioned live. I mean, mm-hmm. so we were always constantly mirroring what was going on. And we would only lose at most 5 transactions.
Wow.
So we could lose the whole East Coast. Mm-hmm. But as we were looking at this, we said, okay, how do we back up on systems? How do we back up on people? And that became very, very critical. And we started looking for a backup location. I presented a plan, I think, by the next board meeting mm-hmm. to the board in terms of business continuity.
Right.
What are we going to be doing? And the plan for having a third data center that would be very remote, for having people moved out, all of the elements of that were in there. We finally located Tampa. Part mm-hmm. of it had to do with the August blackout of 2003, I think it was, when we realized we couldn't be in the same grid if we were to continue wow. to process. So we actually selected Tampa. The interesting thing, we selected Tampa because we could get a good available workforce. It was mm-hmm. on a different grid. It was a good cost environment. Mm-hmm. But the headline when we moved down there, and we brought 500 jobs, which was 500 technical, high-paying jobs, which is very good. The headline in the paper was, Florida girl comes home. So we did that. But the other thing that we did, and I remember talking to the Fed and talking to the Bank of England and talking to a lot of the central banks, I also made certain that none of our senior officers, that we did not have everyone in the office at the same time.
Okay, so it was sort of like the vice president, you know, you had
exactly.
to have the vice president.
Exactly. And we would.
Dick Cheney was hidden somewhere in a
right.
bunker, and we had one person hidden.
And
also.
We had it, and no one could be south of 14th Street. And we had another office where someone could work because we needed to have someone. Mm-hmm. And we rotated so that for senior officers, one would always be out.
Right.
And all the way through. And then we did desktop planning.
Okay.
And there's nothing, James, that focuses your attention when you're the night shift supervisor, just sort of being really happy, and you say, we would take the attendance records and say, you know what? you're the person in charge. What would you do? And we would run scenarios in terms of business continuity planning.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, Treasury sort of pointed to us as being the first in getting things together and as a model for how we were going to do it. But it really focused our attention in terms of business continuity planning and how we were going to proceed.
Okay. Do you think the events put a delay or had any impact on DTC's larger plans for business development, so creating the subsidiaries during this period?
Absolutely. We had just gotten approval for the Euro CCP, which was going to support NASDAQ.
Tell me a little about Euro CCP. We want to talk about that. So.
Okay. Well, Euro CCP was to bring clearance and settlement using the netting model, the robust U.S. model for securities in Europe. And NASDAQ had spoken with us about doing it. We got it up in about 9 months' period of time, got FSA, the Financial Services Authority in the U.K., approval, and they said, when do you need it by? And my husband's birthday was September 15th, and I said, September 15th. And it was approved September 13th, 2001. Yeah. But the world had changed.
Right.
So we did not proceed with the Euro CCP. Mm-hmm. We put it
on the back burner.
And then when turquoise came about, we took Euro CCP and brought it back up. And now it's functioning and running quite well. But the original didn't take off. Plus, after 2001, the markets had changed. Things slowed down. People were not willing to make such investments, we had to put that on the back shelf.
Okay. Another big initiative was the creation of FICC, the Fixed Income Corporation.
When everyone looked and saw how well the merger had worked, and that we were actually not only gotten through the merger, but were able to innovate, get a AAA rating, set up OMGO, come up with new products, they said, we should be bringing more under this umbrella, number one, to have the kind of oversight that was necessary.
Right.
The risk management, and we brought in the MBSCC and the GSCC, which is the government securities. And then when we brought them in individually, then we combined the two of them under one umbrella as the FICC. So then you had DTC, FICC, and NSCC, all of which were triple A rated by S&P under the umbrella of DTCC.
You also created a clearing system for derivatives?
Oh, yes. DerivServe.
Yes.
Okay. You know, you talk about the paper crisis that was there in the 60s and 70s. Well, we had a paper crisis. This time it was in derivatives.
Right.
And instead of having clerks, you had MBAs taking faxes and trying to match derivative transactions.
Probably lawyers too, right?
Oh, and lots of lawyers. I think that the derivatives transactions were not confirmed for about 2 weeks, sometimes months. And the industry came and said, we've got a problem. How are we going to handle this? How are we going to go about fixing this? And we talked about, I think the confirmation rate was about 15% when they came to us. And we said, well, you know, we've got matching engines here. We've got confirmation. Let's see what we can do. And we talked about it, and we started building this on some of the technology, the 100-day plan. How can we change our architecture? How can we be more responsive? And we built something to do credit default swap matching. And we had it up in 9 months. Well, no one thought we were going to have it ready in 9 months, so we were ready, and our clients weren't that fast.
Was it based in part on existing software?
Yes.
Modifications to it?
Yes, modifications to it. But we had, I think, 200 programmers working on it. We really went full bore at this because we saw this as a real risk in the financial services. So we did the credit default swaps. Then we did, I think, the equity derivatives and then interest rate derivatives.
Right.
At the same time, we were working with ISDA. And part of automating was not so much the technical thing of it. It was, how do you get the standards? You know, everyone wants to standardize so long as it's their standard. So we worked with ISDA in terms of getting the fields that we could use that could be automated.
Because ISDA had already done a lot of work in terms of standardizing the derivatives.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But now we needed to standardize it that it could be automated, mm-hmm. if you want. And people started really buying into it. And then we came up with the trade warehouse, which would be holding what we called the golden copy of the mm-hmm. contract, and that would be the legally binding copy. This would be the one that would be considered, and that was kept in the trade warehouse.
And regulators had access to that too, right?
Yes. Eventually mm-hmm. we had the regulators see that, and that was very, very helpful during the 2008 financial crisis that everyone
okay.
was
yeah.
available to see.
We'll talk about
there.
That in just a minute. We might come back to the derivative stuff. First of all, I'd like to ask you about another regulatory issue. That was Regulation SHO, which had to do with an issue called naked short selling. What was that exactly?
Okay. Well, short selling is a trading strategy where a broker dealer or investor believes that the stock is overvalued and that it's likely to decline. So what they do is they borrow stock that they don't own, they sell the stock on the open market, and then they buy it back at a later date, hopefully at a lower price.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you make a profit.
Right.
Okay. Now, naked short selling is you don't really own the stock, but you've sold it. Okay. It's a trading activity. And as far as DTCC is concerned, we have no clue as to whether or not it's a short. We just look at the buys and sells. We mm-hmm. don't know whether it's a short. We don't know whether it's a naked short. I think people looking at the size of DTCC, we had about $1.3 billion in revenue at the time, and we also process $1.53 trillion a day, which if you want to mm-hmm. explain what that is, thought that this was a really good deep pocket to go after. And we had about 12 lawsuits that were filed against us. Nine of them were dismissed outright in the courts. Three of them wound through. I think they've all been resolved. But we worked with the SEC. The SEC went and filed amicus briefs mm-hmm. in order to say this does not make sense. DTCC is not what's accounting for the fails.
Right.
Fails occur mm-hmm. not because someone didn't own the share. It's because we used to lose about 1.7 mm-hmm. million certificates a year, physical certificates. Sometimes the certificate didn't get to the broker in time. Sometimes it was delivered late.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it was misdelivered. So it was just a bit of a scene. But the SEC was very, very much in our our corner, and Reg SHO actually allows for naked short selling,
mm-hmm.
but we report all fails if they're greater than, I think, 10,000 shares
right.
In the marketplace. We report to the marketplace and report to SEC. We don't do a global announcement because that would give away people's positioning and their strategies. And then it goes on a threshold list.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's more than, I think, 0.5% of the outstanding shares
mm-hmm.
Of a security, then it gets triggered, and you have 13 days, actually, to cure.
Okay.
So it's been taken care of. It became a very, very big issue, I think, because people didn't quite understand, if you want, the wonkishness
mm-hmm.
of what goes on in clearance and settlement. Plus, I think there were some very opportunistic
mm-hmm.
lawyers who had made a lot of money in the tobacco settlements.
Now, did the DTC's participants get involved in this issue? Were they very vocal about that, or was it something that was kind of abstract for them?
I think it was more abstract for them. I think they were probably involved if there was going to be any
mm-hmm.
regulation that would prohibit doing a short sale or naked shorts. And but they were also aware of why fails occur. Fails
mm-hmm.
occur because
people make mistakes.
People make mistakes. No matter how automated you are, there's always a person involved somewhere, and we still do have a lot of paper certificates around.
Okay, you mentioned that DTCC had processed 1.5 quadrillion Tough to even get that out,
yes,
isn't it? In securities,
yeah,
transactions. How much is that?
Well, you know, if you just go back to my biochemistry days when I was counting unicellular organisms, we got into the high numbers. And I used to walk around with a slide rule, and I knew logarithms. And I knew that we were doing 900 million billion, and that soon we would cross the line, and it would be, on a yearly basis, we would process over a quadrillion. Quadrillion is one with 15 zeros.
Wow.
And if you try to figure out what does that mean, if you were to take a mile of beach, dig a foot deep and 100 feet wide, and then counted the grains of sand, that would be a quadrillion. And we were doing $1.53 quadrillion dollars worth of transactions.
Wow.
We even had an annual report whose title was, What's a Quadrillion?
Yep. Really makes you think, huh? Gosh. So in August 2006, you turned over your duties as president to Don Donahue.
Right. I was chairman and CEO.
Okay.
I turned over the CEO duties to Don Donahue, and then I became executive chairman. Part of good corporate governance, and this also goes back to writing a paper on corporate governance, mm-hmm. has to do with succession planning. And I started talking to the board very early on about succession planning and who were the potential candidates and how we could start testing them and what we wanted to do and how we could have a smooth transition and how you would make it work, mm-hmm. that I would be there and then I would move on to executive chair and Don would become CEO and then I would stay on as executive chair and then I went on to an advisor. So it was a very, very smooth transition, which is something that you need. We also had our hit by the bus plan for everyone around the complex. Mm-hmm. But that was succession planning, and Don took over.
Yeah.
And I had been working with Don, I guess, since 1991 when I first went on the board.
So you felt like you were in good hands.
I knew it was in good hands, and the board was very used to Don. He had been president of the company, and they were familiar with him. He was at all our board meetings.
Right. So, okay, well, since you've left DTCC, you've done a number of interesting things. There's just one I want to talk with you about today because we're running out of time. You served as one of the trustees for the American Insurance Group after its troubles. I believe you started up with that in January 2009?
Well, actually, with AIG, it was late September, early October of 2008. Think about what was going on. Lehman had failed. Merrill had failed. There was a loss of confidence in the marketplaces. Housing prices were falling. The credit markets are frozen. Actually, when it first began, I had visions of the S&L crisis. But this was a heck of a lot worse. In the end of September, October, I got a call from someone at the Fed and asked if I would consider becoming a trustee for AIG. And I said, oh, I'm doing a lot of other things. I don't know whether I have the time. But then again, I thought, you know what? If I can contribute, this is such a dark time in the financial services. My whole career has been in financial services. I've had the regulatory background. I've had the public service. I've had the private side of things. And it really, two things. Number one was a very selfish, boy, do I want to be where the action is.
Wow.
And the other one was, I think, very altruistic. If I can help with the United States markets, I would do it. So we had lots of discussions about what the role of the trustee would be, how the trustees would function. And then in January of 2009, we were formally appointed as a trustee.
So how did you see your role? Did you see yourself as accountable to the government or to investors more generally, or did you see yourself as
totally
independent?
Totally independent, and we were there to protect the government and the taxpayers. The Fed had taken a 79.9% interest in AIG in exchange for the loan. Now, the loan that they made initially was $85 billion. Mm-hmm. It was collateralized. They were doing this to stabilize AIG. AIG was in
I think, 140 different countries and had tentacles wherever you could name it. They had counterparties all over the world. They had pension funds. They had 76 million customers.
So there was sort of a learning phase in this assignment where you had to understand their business.
Understand their business, understand what was going on there, and understand what was going on in the greater environment, because the success or failure of AIG not only had to do with AIG, it had to do with the markets, it had to do with the economy, it had to do with the way the world was going to move forward. So it was probably the most challenging event that I ever took on.
Now you were an overseer, is that correct?
We were the shareholders.
You were the
This was something that was very difficult for Congress to understand, very difficult for a lot of people to understand. We held the shares on behalf of the U.S. Treasury. And it was not the U.S. Treasury Department. It was the U.S. Treasury. In other words, the taxpayers. And we were to make certain that, number one, we voted the shares at the annual meetings, that there was good governance in place, and that we were able to come up with a plan to dispose of these shares in a value-maximizing manner.
So was your primary contact at the company the board, or did you also deal with the administration?
We dealt with the Fed. Okay, we dealt with Treasury. Okay. We dealt with the board. We dealt with the company. We met once a week for several hours, and then once a month we would meet for a full day. We met with the external auditors. We met with the internal auditors. We met with the compensation people. We met with the PASAR. We met with Treasury. We met with the Fed. We met with the investment bankers. You name it, we met with the lawyers. There was probably no large financial support institution in terms of audit, investment banker, and lawyers that we did not meet with at any given time. As a matter of fact, it was a little difficult for us at times to find someone who was not already compromised by working for somebody along the way. But it was, number one, when we, I think if you remember back to March of 2009, when the CEO of, and he had just been appointed CEO, had to testify before Congress, and he was beaten up unmercifully. And this was a man who had come in, taken a dollar a year, and had volunteered. And at that point, we saw that AIG was losing all credibility in the eyes of the public and in the eyes of the Congress, and decided as shareholders we were going to replace the board. And we actually did a wholesale replacement of the board. Some of the board members were just exhausted and whipped. Others were like deer caught in the headlights. Plus, we needed people who had a skill set who had been involved in a very different kind of market.
Right.
Those who had financial services background, those who had been in workouts, those who had retrieved failing corporations. We brought on a brand new board. And then the board hired a new CEO. We were not the board, and we were not management. We were a shareholder. Of course, when you own 79.9%, you're a pretty big shareholder. But Congress didn't quite understand why we weren't sitting in a sub-basement somewhere approving chits for expenses.
Right.
And that was a difficult time testifying to Congress and trying to explain our role, the role of the board, the role of management.
Okay. Did the trustees have to intervene much with the business plan, or were you more looking at it and asking questions?
We were looking at it, asking questions. We were bringing our collective wisdom. There were three of us. The vast experience that we had and asking the questions. How do you do this? How do you do that? What happens if this fails? What happens if that doesn't go? If you remember, AIA was going to be sold initially to Prudential in the UK. The laws hadn't changed. They needed a 66 2/3% to make that transaction happen. They couldn't get that. Then they decided to do a public offering in Hong Kong. Alico was sold to MetLife. There were a million pieces moving. We were trying to get the company into a much more stable mode, selling off parts that should be sold off. Initially, the plan was they were going to start selling everything. That was a bad plan. As I pointed out to some members of Congress, we own this, and you are trashing an asset that you own by saying these terrible things about AIG. You collectively are driving down
the price of the asset that we own. So cool it, guys. They didn't quite get it. I still remember talking to one member of Congress who was from Brooklyn, and I said, "You don't trash talk something that you own." I think he got it at that moment. So we worked for 2 years in terms of dealing with the auditors, talking about their risk management, their internal controls, setting up a new board.
One of the big issues that Congress was upset about was bonuses.
Bonuses.
To employees.
And that was such a red herring. Granted, everybody was outraged with what they were seeing and so on and so forth. However, there were some issues out there, which I don't want to dwell on too much, but some of the bonuses were contractually paid. And for Congress to come in and abrogate contracts that were made in a private sector was pretty horrendous. The other thing was people were working in the trenches. It was horrible to be working at AIG. If you recall, there were bus tours. There were hangman's nooses that they had for some of the people there. How are you going to attract and retain the best and the brightest? We asked the AIG management team to come up with a plan in terms of how they were going to institute pay for performance, that they would benchmark to what was going on, that it would not be short-term risk rewarded, that it would take the longer-term view on things, and ask them to report to us on a quarterly basis. We had a lot of conversations with the pay czar who was put in at the time. The issue that we had was, I think people wanted to make a political statement. On the other hand, you had people that needed to be compensated, because why work at AIG if you could go to MetLife, make the same thing, not have your children, your family excoriated? And it was a very, 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 very difficult time. But I don't think that Congress or the public as a whole realized that with such a mega institution as AIG, the largest insurance company in the world at the time, that a lot of it is not captured in computer. A lot of it is in the minds of people, and you need those people there to be able to bring the company back. And I'm happy to say that I think it was January 14th, and we were appointed officially on January 16th of 2009, rather, and in 2011, on January 14th, the Fed was paid back in full with interest, and the trust was dissolved. And then
a successful transition.
A successful transition, but people didn't understand what that time was. Before TARP was set up, the Fed had made that money because it was exigent circumstances to AIG. There was no regulator. There were 50 state regulators, 140 different country regulators. There was no primary regulator. There was no one to have saved the situation. I think there was an incredible job done by the Fed, the Treasury, and I have to say the trust by coming in, because all of this was before TARP. This was all, how do you be creative in the middle of a crisis?
All right, well, Jill, looking back over your long career, did you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, it just seems that looking at it, I like people. I like to deal with people. I seem to like crises, or at least I'm attracted to them. And I like to make things happen. I like to see change occur. And I think we're living in an environment now where we're going to be seeing more and more change coming about.
Hopefully change for the good.
Hopefully change for the good. And some of the things that got set many, many years ago when I first started getting into financial services, technology and globalization, are all the forces that are at work now, and we just better learn to understand them and be able to harness them and use them for the good.
All right. Well, General Considine, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you, James.